Thank you very much for playing, Margaret. It's always appreciated when you do. And maybe you can guess what the theme is today from the hymns I chose. Or maybe you can't. You see what they were all had in common. Better get my notes out. I was going to, as I say, today we're starting a series on all things. It's a term in the Bible for everything God's made in creation. So you saw in the hymns we had, and I think the last one too, plenty of the old hymns that talk about the creation. The modern ones don't tend to do it as much sometimes. So, and it's nice to have a few of the old ones occasionally. I like the new ones very much, but it's nice to have some of the old ones. Well, I was going to read the passage that I was sort of basing what I was going to talk on, and it's from, where are we? Yes, there it is. I can't find it. Because I got J.B. Phillips' version, you see, and it has the verses a bit funny. But I thought I'd read it from that because I think it's easier to follow than... this is from Colossians, the letter to the Colossians, chapter 1, beginning at verse 9. And it's Paul talking to the members of this church he's heard about that are following Jesus, and he's sort of writing to encourage them. And he says, "So you'll understand that since we heard about you, we have never missed you in our prayers. We are asking God that you may see things, as it were, from his point of view, by being given spiritual insight and understanding. We also pray that your outward lives, which men see, may bring credit to your Master's name, and that you may bring joy to his heart by bearing genuine Christian fruit, and that your knowledge of God may grow yet deeper. And as you live this new life, we pray that you will be strengthened from God's boundless resources, so that you will find yourselves able to pass through any experience and endure it with joy. You will even be able to thank God in the midst of pain and distress, because you are privileged to share the lot of those who are living in the light. For we must never forget that he rescued us from the power of darkness and established us in the kingdom of his beloved Son, for it is by his Son alone that we've been redeemed and have had our sins forgiven. Now Christ is the visible expression of the invisible God. He existed before creation began, for it was through him that everything was made, or as it says in the NIV, all things, whether spiritual or material, seen or unseen. Through him and for him also were created power and dominion, ownership and authority. In fact, every single thing was created through and for him. He is both the first principle and the upholding principle of the whole scheme of creation. And now he's the head of the body, which is the church. Life from nothing began through him, and life from the dead began through him, and he is therefore justly called the Lord of all. It was in him that the full nature of God chose to live, and through him God planned to reconcile in his own person, as it were, everything on earth and everything in heaven by virtue of the sacrifice of the cross. And you yourselves, who were strangers to God, and in fact through the evil things you had done, his spiritual enemies, he's now reconciled you through the death of his body on the cross, so that he might welcome you to his presence, clean and pure, without blame or reproach. This reconciliation assumes, of course, that you maintain a firm position in the faith and do not allow yourselves to be shifted away from the hope of the gospel, which you have heard, and which indeed the whole world is now having an opportunity of hearing." So it's a fairly long passage, but I hope it helps us understand things and see things. And as I say, this is the first talk about all things. And we're going to have two more talks on it, which Paul's going to do in 2 weeks and 3 weeks, on how God sustains his creation, and then how it's renewed with the culmination of that last day when Jesus comes again. As I said, that passage from Colossians we just read, I think gives a wonderful summary of God being the author of creation. But we also notice, don't we, that it's Jesus who has the role of creator. He's the member of the Godhead involved in our physical world. Remember, Jesus is also called the creator by John, isn't he, at the beginning of John's Gospel. You know, through him, meaning Jesus, the Word, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. And as it says in that passage, Jesus created all things in heaven as well as earth, both visible and invisible. Now, many people today take heaven and earth to mean heaven's that vast space out there, enormous space, isn't it? And it's planet Earth where we are here. But to us, as Christians, heaven also is that mysterious abode, isn't it, where God and the angels are. And it's not a location in space, it's everywhere. It's all around us, just that we can't see it and can't get to it, can we? And talking of the creation, we can read the account of creation in Genesis 1. But I thought we'd get a better view of creation if we read it in Psalm 8, because that's got the emphasis better. I think in Genesis chapter 1, we just see each of the days as sort of equivalent, as if everything's equally important. But if we read Psalm 8, we see it slightly differently. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. From the lips of children and infants you have ordained praise, because of your enemies, to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels, or the heavenly beings, it says here, and crowned him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds and beasts of the field, birds of the air and fish of the sea, and all that swim the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And I say that's a contrast to the general view of creation of the universe that you get if we read books and watch the TV. Because TVs, what they do is they're sort of extolling this universe, don't they? How it's so enormous, you know, 13.7 billion years old and 13.7 light years across and absolutely gigantic with all those 10 to the power of 22 stars and everything else. And then what else do you get on the television and the books? You get all these books about animals, and aren't they lovely? You know, Lonely Planet, and we study them and we see how fantastic all these animals are and what they can do and all the things that go on, and the plants as well. And then we don't have the same sort of thing about man on the television. About the wonder of man, you just get illnesses and trying to make him better and all these sort of things. And we all want to live forever because we're going to die and that's it. That's the sort of the attitude of the television, isn't it? And it's also the other thing is all the politics, you know, how man's made such a mess of it and everything's awful and it's all going wrong. Again, it's very negative about man. But that Psalm 8 is totally the other way around. It starts with, you know, creation, so what? And it's man that's the total focus. And I thought of it as a picture of the creation story. It's a bit more like preparing for a play. And all that huge, vast universe, well, that's just the scenery. And planet Earth, oh, well, that's just the stage. And then you can say, what about all the animals? Well, they're just the props and the supporting cast. And it's the main performer, us, is us, mankind. And then who's the hero? Jesus. And who's the heroine in the play? The church. And if we focus it that way round, we see the relative importance of us as the centre of creation, which the world doesn't see at all. And as I say, as Christians then, we don't need to argue too much about how long it took to make the scenery, whether it's 13.7 billion years or a few thousand. I don't think that really matters anything like as much, does it, as the fact we're at the centre of the play. And then we've got even more, because Paul said, the Apostle Paul, I have to say that because we think of Paul as something else, don't we? The Apostle Paul talks about the invisible things that were created. He talks about thrones, powers, rulers and authorities. And again, it's not the way we tend to think these days, isn't it? But by thrones and rulers, he means those governing us and the hidden power behind them. And I suppose you could say it's all the powers of politics, the unseen influences that govern decisions, everything that goes on like that, that we don't really know about and nobody knows about. It's just people's interactions, isn't it? But what Paul is saying, the way he sees it, there's a spirit world out there that's influencing as well. There's both good and bad spirits. We know about fallen angels, it talks about in the Bible. So in heaven, there's two sorts of heaven, really. As well as the heaven, I talk about the heavens, and the heaven where God dwells, there's obviously a heaven where the devils are too. There's bad spirits as well as good spirits. And then there's the real heaven, the lovely heaven, where God is. It's very complicated, but it is beyond us to understand. I mean, there was old Paul talking about being taken up to the seventh heaven or something, doesn't he? And he says, you wouldn't understand it, so I'm not going to tell you. But we just know it's going to be lovely in the ultimate, don't we? And it just struck me that science thinks that we've understood nearly everything, as I say, but there's far more to it, far more. We have only understood a tiny part of this world of ours, haven't we, when we think about all these influences and things that go on within us. And I was thinking, too, that it's amazing, this God of ours, that he did the creation, but what was the main thing, the most wonderful thing he created? Us. And he created creators. He wanted to expand his creation, and there's all our... We're the only things in the universe that's got creativity, that can do things, interact, talk. It's amazing what we've got here. And yet, often in the people in the world, they don't see that, do they? They see it all the wrong way round. You know, I mean, they talk about knowing and understanding nearly everything, but if you take the Big Bang or whatever, we don't know what happened outside time. We can't get beyond that. We're completely constrained by that. We can never know everything. And, of course, the other thing that people argue about is whether there's guidance in the universe. I mean, you can believe that we're here by some incredibly tiny, small chance. You know, there's probably things like 10 to the power of 30 in it, or even 10 to the power of 120 in it. You know, the chance that we're here, it's just utterly ridiculous. And yet they want to believe that, rather than believe there's a guiding influence, there's a God behind it. And of course, if we look for the guiding influence, well, we can see it in some of those hymns, you know, and think how wonderful the universe is and the animals and everything else. But some people don't want to see it there. And as I was thinking, God hasn't really left concrete scientific evidence of the guidance, and we can't find it. But that's part of his not wanting to force belief on us. It's the same sort of thing as the messianic secret from Jesus, when he didn't really declare always exactly straight who he was, did he? Because he didn't want to cause complete chaos by, you know, convincing absolutely everybody. Because it's not the way the plan is meant to work, is it? The plan's meant to work through us, changing the world. As it says in the passage, doesn't it? For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in Jesus, and through him to reconcile to himself all things. There's the all things again. Whether things on earth or in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. You see, and that's a pretty amazing thing when you look into it. You see, it's not just mankind that's the pinnacle of creation, but it's Jesus in the flesh on the cross. It's at one point in time in history is the pinnacle of it all, where it all comes together. And in that particular expression, if you notice, it says, whether things on earth or in heaven, by making peace through his blood. It doesn't say heaven and earth. Usually in the Bible, it talks about heaven and earth. You know, heaven's a bit superior to earth. But it says earth and heaven. Interesting, isn't it? Because earth is where the action is. It's here on earth we're going to sort out heaven. I talked about the bad heaven, or whatever you want to call it, and the fallen angels and all the rest of it, the serpent in the Garden of Eden, good heavens. But all that spiritual side has got to be sorted out as well as us here on earth. And God's plan, amazing as it is he's created us to sort out heaven as well as earth. It's amazing, isn't it? And that's what Jesus' death on the cross did. It changed all creation, the heaven and the earth. And that's what's even, again, incredible, is that when Jesus does come again, heaven and earth are going to be combined. And that means we're not going to have time anymore. And that explains to some extent, little as we can understand it, how we'll be able to live forever. Because if you sometimes worry about how on earth we're going to live forever without being bored out of our minds, well, if we don't have time, there's no problem about that. And as I say, this passage from Colossians, as I read it, began at verse 9, where Paul's saying he's praying for the church and he's asking God to fill them with the knowledge of his will through all spiritual wisdom and understanding. And we need the same. A lot of that passage, I think, could have applied to us, couldn't it? We need that same knowledge. And if we are part of God's plan to restore creation, we need it. And this is something else I wanted just to mention, if you like. It's how do we know God's plan more fully and how to do it? Well, the part of the reason I've thought this way is I was given some books by Alistair McGrath. You know, he's a philosopher, Christian philosopher, and he's really good to read. You know, his wife's a friend of Jill Morgan. And he was talking about one of the books about the Reformation, another one about doctrine and where we get it from. And it's really fascinating about the church and all the different churches and what's all behind it and what we should be doing. And just to give you a bit of history, if you like, you know, in the early church, they had the apostles and the Old Testament for guidance, didn't they? And they had the stories and sayings of Jesus. And then later, you know, a few years later, came the New Testament and the creeds. And they were agreed by the whole church. But the creeds are only very basic statements, really, just sort of Jesus is Lord and God raised him from the dead, if you remember what enough of us are probably Anglicans and things, and we remember the creed and know what it says, don't we? Those basic statements that we all agree. But more detailed teaching obviously came from the Bible as a whole. And it's more difficult with the interpretation sometimes, isn't it? Because the Bible says one thing here and one thing there. And for 1,000 years, it was the church that interpreted the Bible. And then we came up to the Reformation, where the church had maybe drifted a bit in a few areas, and the reformers wanted to change it. And they wanted interpretation, if you like, from everybody. Everybody could read the Bible and say what they felt. And they wanted to stay in the church, but in the Catholic Church, but it just meant they'd open the floodgates and it couldn't happen. And that's the world we live in today, where there's lots of different interpretations and different ways of looking at it. And this is what the book from Alistair McGrath was about. How do you choose the right one? What do we rely on? And he says that really, it's a bit like the creeds and things. The core, it's like the skeleton, I suppose. We all agree. But otherwise, we need to be slightly more open-minded. And people haven't been open-minded in the past. And that's why they've burnt people on the stake and called them heretics and all the rest of it. And hopefully we've moved from that. But it means that we have to be slightly flexible, don't we? We can believe one thing, but realise that we can't be absolutely sure it's right. And nobody's completely right on this, and nobody's completely right on that. And you say, what are you talking about, Andrew? Can you give us some examples? Well, you know, can a Christian lose his faith and place in heaven? Well, some passages say yes, and some passages say no. And I could quote you, I haven't time, but I could quote you loads, you know, and I've heard sermons on this which say one side or the other. And it's unfortunate. But we've got it even in this passage in Colossians, you see. We've got one of the sides. It says in verse 22 and 23, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight without accusation, if you continue in the faith, established and firm, not moved from the hope held out in the gospel. Or as it said in my J.V. Phillips, this reconciliation assumes, of course, you maintain a firm position in the faith. So that's definitely saying you can lose your faith, that one is. And, well, what do we do about that? Well, the point is that both are true. You can lose your faith and you can't lose your faith. And you definitely can lose your faith and you definitely can't lose your faith. You say, well, how can you... This is Christianity. We have paradoxes. We've got an amazing religion. We have irreconcilable truths. Jesus is the reconcilable, isn't he? But we have him that to us are irreconcilable. And what do we do with that? Well, you see, it's wonderful, isn't it? Because if you're feeling, you know, worried and upset about it and worrying about it, well, there you are. You can definitely never lose your faith. If you're being very blasé about it and sinning a bit on the side and this, that and the other, well, you need the other passage. Watch out. Maybe you could. And that's fine. It's wonderful. And then God can speak to the right one, to the right person. Just make sure you don't get it the wrong way round. You look worried, Ishbel. Good. But I've got a... There's loads of other ones of these examples I could give you. But there's one I should just today, because I was told it's World Environment Day on June the 5th, and the focus is on plastics. And again, plastics is something that we can use wisely or use badly, isn't it? Again, it's a paradox, isn't it? They're a blessing. But look what they're doing to the animal world in the oceans. Look at all the troubles. We just read all about that, don't we, about all the troubles with them. And there's me. I've worked on plastics all my working life, didn't I? And, you know, making cigarette wrapping. Ooh, but making X-ray film. Hooray, you see? We couldn't live without plastics, and there's good and bad in there, isn't there? And I think we should, you know, for these things, campaign at both extremes. You know, hate the sin and love the sinner extremely. And I was just thinking one example you could do is buy double-sized products. I worked with that myself. If you bought the big sizes of everything half as often, you'd have 20% less packaging on a big package. Think about that. And it means less trips to the supermarkets and less traffic, etc. There you are, Andrew. You can complain on that. It's a good one, isn't it? Better get back to where I was. I say Jesus didn't say much doctrine directly. We don't get doctrine statements from Jesus. We just get irreconcilable opposites, don't we? But he taught through illustrations. And the reason I just bring this one up, it came up again the other day. Often things I talk about in sermons, things strike me the week before and they come forward. And the parables of Jesus, I think, help us understand God better sometimes than doctrine does. And I used the example of the prodigal son, remember in the Bear's Paw last Sunday. And I thought about it, you see, and it taught me more about going to heaven and hell than any number of Bible verses. Because there's the prodigal son. He stayed where he was in poverty. And he realized his wretchedness. And he came back on his knees to the Father. And he asked for the bare minimum. You know, make me one of your hired servants, didn't he? Or slave, as I was saying the other day. But what happened? The Father gave him the marvelous welcome, ran out to meet him, and had a great feast for him. And you know, that's the picture of the penitent coming to heaven, isn't it, who might have stayed away. But, of course, there's always the elder brother. And I think that's just as important a bit of the parable, isn't it? He was among the chosen. He was staying with his Father. He was, you'd have thought, there already. But he didn't want to go into the feast, did he? I'm not going in there where he is and having all that fuss about him. I'm not going in there. See? And then that's where the parable ends. Did he go to heaven? Did he not? Jesus leaves it open. But it's, you know, we don't know if he was persuaded to go to that glorious heaven. And that's more of the challenge for us, isn't it, than the other one to think about. And there's Jesus' teaching, really, as I say, teaching me more than all of that. And I say that there are other passages in the Bible which, well, what that one was saying was it's people choose not to go to heaven. But there are other passages in the Bible which talk about God sending people directly to heaven, don't they? And again, that's all part of this paradox that we have to cope with. And I think, you know, just as an aside, I was thinking we should do more of this in our sermons or whatever and Bible studies and the rest of it. Work ways through these paradoxes together. I mean, we've had the vote in Ireland. Which way would you have voted? Some probably one way, some the other. Well, we need to talk about that, understand it, understand the other's positions. And again, I mean, I'm dead against abortion. I hate abortion, but I love the poor person that's stuck with it and troubled with it. And I would say that I can understand there are cases when maybe abortion's the way, but you can, because you're a loving person. And that's the sort of paradox where we have to deal with it. But, you know, why would God send people to hell? Well, because even the tiniest amount of sin is going to ruin heaven, isn't it? You know, there's a quote from C.S. Lewis I thought that was good. He said, there are two sorts of people going to be at the end. Those two who say to God, thy will be done. And those to whom God says, thy will be done. Yeah, it's quite interesting the way he's pithy, way he said it, isn't it? That some people are going to, God's going to say, well, you didn't want to go in, so you're not going in. And other people are going to say, Lord, I'm here. You know, whatever you want, I'll accept it. And it reminded me also, of course, that other famous parable in Luke, you know, the Good Samaritan. Because he loved his neighbour, didn't he? And we're told to do that as the second great commandment, aren't we? Love your neighbour. And it just struck me again that it's something our country could learn, isn't it? Because our neighbours are often the people we don't like to associate with. Even immigrants, you know, and our country isn't very good about that at the moment, is it? And it struck me too that should we encourage our nation to be less self-centred and less belligerent? You know, spending more on aid and less on alms. You know, and if we're part of this process of renewing all things, we should be maybe more outspoken in areas like that. Again, as an aside, I went with John and Ruth to a lecture in Manchester the other day, and there was this doctor was there talking about this surgeon, how he'd been out to battlefields and places like Syria and Libya where there's strife, and healing people, you know, as a surgeon, putting them back together again from explosions and bullet wounds and everything else. And it was interesting hearing him talk about that, how as a surgeon he'd had to learn to be able to do anything. Like you have a lady who's been shot but is also 9 months pregnant, so you have to give her a cesarean while you're doing it. And of course, modern surgeons are hopeless in that respect, and they specialise on just doing one thing. And he had to be able to do anything. And he was teaching other surgeons to do that too. But the thing that struck me at the end was not just how wonderful he was, but why on earth do we have all these wars and troubles and everything else? And, you know, our nation, here's me going off track a bit, our nation is just as bad. We didn't need to fight for things like the Falklands War, or half the things that we fight. The First World War was totally unnecessary. The Germans were pleading for peace by 1917, and we refused it and totally ignored it and wouldn't have anything to do with it. Why? Because we didn't love our neighbour. Oh, those horrible Germans, we're not going to have peace with them. They need to be taught a lesson. And yet we could have had peace. You know, oh, we didn't want Germany having a little bit of France. We couldn't cope with that. But, you know, that's just an example of the way things have gone. And maybe these are the things we should speak out about. I don't know. I've gone on too much there. But let me finish now anyway. And I was going to read another further verse in Colossians 1 that I didn't get to. And it's, therefore we proclaim Christ, admonishing and teaching everyone with all wisdom, so that we may present everyone, and that's all men, perfect in him. Well, thank you for putting up with me. I hope you understood all I was on about. Thank you.